Blog Talk Radio.
Choices made by politicians on both parties for more than a generation.
These policy choices had victims with first and last names, millions of displaced workers, shuttered factories, and hollowed-out communities across the country, hobbled by shrinking tax bases that no longer could support vital public services.
Both the industrialization and the dysfunction of finance contributed to a remarkable rise in economic inequality starting in the late 1970s. Trade deficits and offshore wiped out millions of well-paying middle-class jobs, and the threat of offshoring held down wages for all workers. But a long list of other deliberate policy choices also played key roles in the rise of inequality. These included the abandonment of full employment in favor of fighting inflation, the prolonged attack on workers' rights to organize and bargain collectively with their employers, the erosion of the minimum wage and other labor protections, and massive tax cuts for the wealthy. In the end, nearly two-thirds of the pre-tax income gains after 1979 were captured by the richest 10%, and more than half was captured by the richest 1%. The experience of these policy mistakes caused the growth engine of the U.S. economy to sputter. Starting in the early 1980s, the economy's average annual growth rate slowed considerably in comparison with the post-war period. The expansion of the Bush years was the weakest since World War II in terms of output growth, investment growth, employment growth, and wage growth. In fact, the Bush expansion was the first since World War II in which real income for the typical middle-class family actually declined. There was clearly something wrong with the U.S. economy long before the crash. The weakness of the economy was temporarily papered over by a bubble in real estate prices at the turn of the 21st century, which was made possible by the deregulation of Wall Street. Instead of broad-based, sustainable growth fueled by rising wages and investment, the U.S. economy was artificially inflated by complex financial engineering that made credit more easily available and exposed the entire economy to enormous risk. The bubble allowed working families to maintain their standard of living despite stagnant wages by borrowing against the value of their homes and going deeper into debt. But, of course, households could not keep increasing their debt load forever. When the real estate bubble finally burst, the house of cards came crashing down, and working people were once again forced to pay for the sins of Wall Street in their homes, their dreams, and their children's futures.
We are still digging our way out from the rubble of the crash. It typically takes years to repair the damage from the collapse of speculative asset bubbles. When the U.S. real estate bubble burst, households lost more than $10 trillion in wealth from the plunge in housing and stock prices, and they were heavily indebted to begin with. Even today, households are still digging their way out of debt, and it may take years for them to see daylight. This helps explain why progress toward closing our job deficit has been so difficult and why the economic recovery is still so fragile. And another drag on the recovery has been the loss of 765,000 jobs at the state and local levels between 2007 and 2011, more than any modern downturn. The Republican presidential candidates not only failed to learn anything from Wall Street mistakes, they now want to double down on more of the same. They propose to deregulate the financial sector yet again, pass more trade agreements, and encourage the offshoring of U.S. jobs, suppress wages by intensifying the assault on unions, prioritize inflation fighting over full employment, and perpetuate overinflation of the dollar and the U.S. trade deficit. We already tried this approach, and it already failed spectacularly.
The Republican candidates pretend that tax cuts for corporations and the wealthy are the answer to wage stagnation and the economic crisis. But the Duke Bush years taught us that these obscenely wasteful tax cuts only make the problem worse. They are the equivalent of eating our seed corn because they starve the kind of public investment in education, infrastructure, and innovation that is indispensable for long-term economic growth. President Obama has shown that he understands this problem. He said clearly that we are not going back to an economy that's all about outsourcing and bad debt and phony profits. We cannot return to a bubble and bust economy propped up by fleeting bubbles and rampant speculation, and we must make sure such a crisis never happens again. He has called for rebuilding an economy built to last through a sustained program of public investment in infrastructure, education, and innovation. He has called economic inequality the defining issue of our time and sounded the alarm with the decline of the American middle class over the past 30 years. He has opened a national conversation about encouraging businesses to bring jobs back to the U.S. instead of shipping jobs overseas. He has acknowledged that America can no longer serve as the consumer engine for the entire world and called on trading partners that run trade surpluses every year to rebalance their economies by consuming more of what they produce.
What we need now is an economic program. I want to stop for just a second because as much as I disagree with Obama, and I swear to God, there's nothing about this guy that I like, but his trying to, except the one thing where he's trying to encourage the a tax change, you know, and bring back the Bush tax cuts, all right, and bring back taxes on the wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's the only thing that I agree with him, okay, and his entire policies. However, that's such a major issue that it's worth mentioning.
Oh, right? It is the core issue of the election.
If he could do that, I would be very grateful. I would be grateful, but you know, regardless of all his crazy other ass miserable policies, that one policy, all right, that one thing of bringing the tax back.
Economic inequality is a core issue in this election.
It is.
And
if you elect Romney, you know, you're electing a one percenter. Okay? If you elect Obama, then I don't know what you're electing, but you're electing a guy who's trying to proceed with with ending the Bush tax cuts and
looking for economic equality for all people.
Right. So I mean, basically the election's coming down to that. Aside from the wars and aside from the every other god-awful thing, there's only one issue, and that's bringing the American people back to equity, all right? Bringing this system back into some kind of balance, okay? And making those bastards pay, okay, for what they've been stealing, all right, from us. And I'm not saying you're never going to destroy the elite, but you gotta start paying your fair share, guys. All right, and whatever that is, whatever that is, getting back to the 1970s, where you paid 70% of your taxes on 70% of your income. Good. You know, we had a strong middle class then. Right?
Okay, let's just get back to this. I'm just gonna skip this piece here and go down to where there's a solution. If we want to be competitive with Germany and China in the 21st century, we will need trillions of dollars in productive public investment over the next 10 years, in affordable education and apprenticeship programs to young people, I like that idea, who have suffered greater income loss than any other demographic. The infrastructure, energy, manufacturing, transportation, skill training, and upgrades, and new technologies, all of which have been starved by successive rounds of tax cuts for the wealthy and action over long-term federal investment initiatives. Wall Street and the wealthy Americans who have benefited most from the economic policies of the past 30 years will have to start paying their fair share. We need to pass a financial speculation tax. Let the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy expire, tax capital gains at the same rate as ordinary income, and establish a minimum effective tax rate of 30% for households earning more than $1 million.
I agree with that.
Yep.
I agree with that.
Second, to encourage domestic investment and lay stronger and more stable foundation for a long-term growth, it is essential that we tackle the problems of wage stagnation and economic inequality. This will require reforming our labor laws so that all workers who want to form a union and bargain collectively have a fair opportunity to do so, making full employment the highest priority of our economic policy. Well, I agree with that. Increasing and indexing the minimum wage, I agree with that. Shrinking the trade deficit and, again, eliminating incentives for offshoring. Absolutely, sir.
And third, we need to start making things in America again. We cannot hope to revive U.S. manufacturing without bringing our trade deficit under control, which means ending the overvaluation of the U.S. dollar and combating currency manipulations by our trading partners.
Mm-hmm.
We will also need to enhance Buy America safeguards, aggressively enforce our trade laws and incentives for offshoring in the trade code. Tax code and in our trade agreements. Fourth, we need to shrink our bloated financial sector and make it serve the real economy once again. We can no longer afford a financial sector that squanders scarce resources on unproductive gambling and exposes the entire economy to the intolerable risk of speculative bubbles. This means re-regulating Wall Street, eliminating tax advantages for leveraged buyouts, and finding other ways to favor strategic investment over short-term speculation.
Fifth, we expect other countries to stop relying on trade surpluses as their source of growth. We will have to make it easier for them to rely on domestic incomes as their source of growth. This will require a global New Deal that establishes minimum standards for the global economy, prevents a race to the bottom, I agree with that, creates vibrant consumer markets in the global south, and in the process creates new markets for advanced U.S. manufacturing. Yeah, we can't support having people live on dirt in foreign
countries. Right.
That's disgraceful by these American companies.
It is.
Just criminal.
And the World Trade Organization. That's what it's all about. And, you know, that's what's killing our country and killing the world. And we also have unfinished business in digging out from the rubble of the crash. America wants to work, and decisive action to close our job deficit must not be delayed any further. An immediate multi-year program of public investment in infrastructure, clean energy, would draw in business investment and buy time while households dig their way out of debt. To stop the foreclosure epidemic, stabilize housing prices, broad-based reductions in mortgage principal will also be needed. The U.S. economy cannot recover until the housing market, the single largest market in the country, is healthy again, and the banks must be held accountable for their contribution to the crisis.
One thing is clear. We can no longer rely on household debt, real estate bubbles, tech bubbles, stock bubbles, or any other kind of bubbles to fuel our economic growth. We cannot go back to a low-wage, high-consumption economy. We need bold leadership to draw the right lessons and from the mistakes of the past 30 years and forge a new model of economic growth in which we can make things in America again. Workers can form a union and bargain collectively if they want to. Working people can afford to buy the things they make. The U.S. economy produces as much as it consumes. Everybody who wants to work can find a good job, and prosperity is broadly shared.
And I 100% agree with it.
That's a great outline for economic recovery and for what people need.
Okay,
let's do it, guys. Instead of taking, how about giving something while you're down there in Washington?
Absolutely. And if we don't do that, I mean, we're fools. We're absolutely fools. What I'm doing here, I should have done this before.
Are you going to post that?
Yeah.
On Facebook?
Yeah. I should have done this, but I didn't. But it's so good, an article, that I wanted to post it. So,
I'd be anxious to see what people think about that. Will they respond to that maybe on Facebook? It's kind of a long article. And if folks would like to read that, go to the AFL-CIO.org and go into issues. And that essay is in there, very well written.
Yeah.
And
so hopefully we can get this. I don't know.
I hope that gets posted.
I hope so too. I don't know. Things in the paper. That's okay. Anyway, what I wanted to do was I wanted to. I got to get out of this. And I wanted to play this particular. Sorry, folks, the delay. I wanted to play this one. I wanted to read this one article which follows up on what we just read. And it was by, it was relating to Ron Paul.
Oh, okay. Does he have a bill before Congress? Or?
Yeah. Okay. Audit the Fed threatens the secrecy of the Federal Reserve Bank. But I was really kind of pleased to hear.
I think Rand Paul also was.
Well, they're voting for it, yeah. They've had been. But this is kind of good news. Senator audit the Fed threatens the secrecy of the Federal Reserve Bank. It's by InfoWars. Senator Ron Paul, author of legislation called Federal Reserve Transparency Act of 2012, H.R. 459, that will subject Ben Bernanke and the privately owned Federal Reserve Bank to monetary audit policy, has seen much support from his peers on Capitol Hill. The House of Representatives passed 327-98 on a vote last week, which exceeded the necessary two-thirds majority. Bernanke, trying to deter the U.S. Congress from digging into the private matters of the Fed, told House lawmakers that his legislation would allow a nightmare scenario of political meddling and monetary policymaking. Congress is the one that's supposed to make the policy, not this damn Federal Reserve.
Not the Federal Reserve. Who is he to say that?
Yeah, and how pretentious of this head of the global elite banking cartel to say the American representatives would be fumbling idiots, meandering about in the matters of private shareholders, being forced to disclose their agendas regarding our money system. Paul, who is pushing for transparency in America's relationship with the Fed, said the Americans are sick and tired of what happened in the bailouts and where the wealthy got bailed out and the poor lost their jobs and they lost their homes. Back in March, Bernanke lectured at the University of George Washington University in a propaganda stunt to reaffirm to the young generations that the Federal Reserve is necessary and integral to the U.S. monetary future. Ben Bernanke claimed that a central bank is not an ordinary commercial bank but a government agency. That's bullshit. Okay. By fabricating the factual need of the Fed as a cornerstone of our currency system, Bernanke tried to coerce the public on the benefits of the Fed. Dennis Kucinich said that it's time that we stood up to the Federal Reserve that right now acts like some kind of high exalted priesthood unaccountable to democracy. Paul wants to show the American public that their hard-earned money is going into offshore accounts to support the global central banking cartels and fund their agendas. The focus is on the 2007 to 2009 recession that has laid the groundwork for hyperinflation in the near future. The audit legislation is this will direct the Government Accountability Office, which is an independent congressional agency, to oversee a full review of the Fed's monetary policy while conducting an audit of them, and then decisions will be turned over to the Federal Open Market Committee.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, co-author of the NDAA, is now decrying that he's tried to bring a similar legislation to the House back in 1995. Reid asserts, "I've sponsored legislation that would call for an audit of the Federal Reserve System. I offer that amendment every year. Every year the legislation goes nowhere. I think it would be interesting to know about the Federal Reserve. I think we should audit the Federal Reserve. Reed went on to say, it's taxpayers' money that's being used there, but we don't do that. Senator Dorgan has spoken out on the secrecy of the Federal Reserve system. He's spoken out on the Federal Reserve more than anyone that I know in either body. But even though there is no entity in the world that controls our lives more than the Federal Reserve system, his speeches go unnoticed, I'm sorry to say. It is Reed's contention, and quite rightly, that the Fed affect government because of the money that governments borrowed. Since the U.S. government allows its privately owned bank to sell them their currency instead of printing it themselves, as it is allowed by the U.S. Constitution, give the Fed and central banking cartels rule over the American public through the ruse of taxation and the bulldog collection agency known as the Internal Revenue Service. It appears that although Reed was once in support of this type of legislation, he is clearly not today, as he has stated emphatically that the bill will be killed in the Senate.
Because of the central banking cartel takeover of the American people in 1913, with this signing of the Federal Reserve Act, which led to the monetary enslavement we are witnessing today, as well as the transformation of America from a constitutional republic into a nation of serfs, were tied to the conspiratorial endeavors of the global elite. Obama has made it clear that he believes the legislation is a really, really bad idea. Yeah, you know, this is another problem I have with Obama. He's a freaking puppet. You know, in the words of Timothy Geithner, former U.S. Treasury Secretary, asserted that an audit of the Fed is a line that we do not want to cross, and that if the American people successfully audit the Fed, it would be a problematic for the country because they're afraid to death because it would show such fraud. We would have a revolution.
It's not problematic for the country.
No,
it's problematic
for the
Fed.
Yeah.
And former head of the New York Federal Reserve.
No, in other words,
former U.S. Treasury Secretary asserted that an audit of the Fed.
Wait a minute. Former U.S. Treasury Secretary.
Mm-hmm.
He's resigned. When did he resign?
I don't know.
I thought he was still the Secretary of State.
No, it's the U.S. Treasury Secretary.
I mean, U.S. Treasury Secretary. I thought he was still the Treasury Secretary.
I don't know. Asserted that an audit, we'll have to check on that.
Asserted that an audit of the Fed is in line, and we don't want to cross. Hang on one second. I
already read that.
No, I'm quite concerned here all of a sudden because when did Geithner resign? I didn't know that.
Maybe they meant as...
Wait. A former head of the New York... Fed of the New York...
Federal Reserve.
Okay, yeah. I thought they said Secretary of State, former Secretary of State.
No.
Because I knew he was going to resign. He wanted out. But I didn't know. He's still the Secretary of State.
He's the Treasury Secretary.
But it says, the words of Timothy Geithner, former U.S. Treasury Secretary.
He's the former head of the New York Federal Reserve.
Well, that we know.
Yeah.
But hang on a second, because I want to double check this, because this doesn't, I didn't, this article.
They maybe made a mistake on that.
They may have, but I can't let that go, because... Yeah, hang on one second. I'll check that out.
I thought they wouldn't let him resign.
They didn't let him resign. They wouldn't let him resign. I'm going to double check this, folks. Hang on one second.
Well, anyway, it would be excellent if we could get some transparency.
It would be excellent if Geithner did resign, because he's nothing but a sellout, you know.
Goldman Sachs gave a lot of money to Obama, and he has supported them. And that's one problem I do have with him.
He hasn't resigned.
It's just that he won't stay.
He won't stay. That's all it says. I'm looking up on Google here.
He's talking about resigning, but they wouldn't let him go. That's what I thought. If Obama gets a second term, then he'll leave.
Yeah.
And they will replace him with another Goldman Sachs person.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure they'll do that. That's something new to me. You know, I said former. That's not true.
I think that was probably, they meant former.
Maybe it was a misprint.
Yeah.
This thing, because.
And we thought maybe we missed something in the news.
I mean, that's big news.
Of course, with the Olympics, they don't even bother to tell you anything on the mainstream.
He says he wants to resign after debt ceiling debate was resolved. That was July 3rd, June 30th. That was on drugs. But, he hasn't resigned. We would have heard that.
Magner
was asked to resign in November 2009, but he didn't. There's nothing to support that he resigned. So, I'm going to ask you to just acknowledge that. Maybe Warner Bros. Should continue with that article because it's bogus.
Well, they made an error there. That's all.
Well,
could have been a typing error. They might have meant.
In the words of Timothy Geithner, former U.S. Treasury Secretary.
They probably mean former Federal Reserve.
Asserted
that an audit of the Fed is in line that we don't want to cross, and that if the American people successfully audit the Fed, it would be problematic for the country. I think it would be problematic for the Fed.
Oh, it would. Definitely would. But anyway, Congress votes for Ron Paul's audit of the Fed, which is what the whole article really is about. And there's a little audio piece here. There's something by...
Well, he's come up short in his run for the White House. Ron Paul can claim a big victory today. The U.S. House overwhelmingly approved a bill sponsored by the Texas Republican that would expand congressional authority to oversee the Federal Reserve. The legislation comes after more than three decades of activism by Paul, who has pushed for greater transparency at the central bank since he was first elected in 1976. The vote was 327-98. Now, sorry to be a buzzkill here, but the audit the Fed bill is going nowhere in the U.S. Senate. In fact, they refused to take it up. The vote served as a symbolic swan song for Paul, who is not seeking re-election. Paul made auditing the Fed a signature platform of his presidential campaign, and it has become a rallying cry from his supporters. Since the 2008 financial collapse, Paul's economic views has gained more attention, particularly within the Republican Party. And that's not easy for some Republicans to admit. Ron Paul has the nickname in Congress, Dr. No, for usually voting against all financial matters, including those popular within his own party.
So that's pretty much what happened there, folks. And
so they can I didn't realize that they could refuse to take up the bill.
Well, the Senate can do whatever they want. They get bills from the House all the time.
Mm.
And it's the same with the House. The House can do the same thing. They can refuse bills from the Senate.
Only the House can form.
No, what happens is bills from the Senate go down to the House as well, right, to be approved, and vice versa, right? So that's, and they can do whatever they want with that. But it seems like the House, the Senate, is a bunch of sellouts. And, that's the way it is.
And it was overwhelmingly passed. You think they'd be forced to take it up?
You would think so, But, they could do it. They could actually do that by bypassing the Senate, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And if the president...
Was supportive.
Was supportive. The president doesn't want to do it either, so he would veto that bill. So, it's a complete joke. Anyway, federal court upholds the herding of demonstrators into free speech zones. There was once a group of men who established the fundamental law of the land that allowed the people of their newfound concert to peaceably assemble and petition their governments for an redress,
redress.
A redress of the grievances. These founding fathers of the great nations even went so far as to declare the government itself could never make a law that would threaten to supplant these protections, which were reserved exclusively for the people. Well, this concept of freedom of assembly and protest was so critical to protecting and preserving the liberty of people that it was the first, very first law, the very first amendment that proposed by the new elected representatives of this United States of America and came into effect December 15, 1791. It's frightening that just a couple of hundred years of politicking, self-serving greed and expediency can do to a nation. Apparently, someone along the way, politicians and judges who hold their personal views in higher regard than those laws upon which this nation was founded, have taken it upon themselves to decide what's best for the American people and that perhaps we have a little too much liberty. Amazing, isn't it?
That's disgusting.
Yeah.
I think that's...
A federal appeals court has upheld the creation of no demonstration zones, which prohibit free speech in certain public areas. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals released a ruling yesterday upholding a lower court decision that allows declared such zones as being permissible. The opinion was penned by Judge Dennis Jacobs on behalf of a three-judge panel that includes judges Pierre Laval and Deborah Ann Livingston, two of whom are Republican judges appointed by G.H.W. Bush. Yeah, I tell you. The case surrounded
an arrest that took place in 2004 when Michael Markovich of Repent America and Steve LaFemme of Columbia Christians for Life attended the Republican National Convention in Madison Square Garden to address the large number of pro-abortion speakers at the event, including Rudy Giuliani and Arnold Schwarzenegger. According to court records, the two were standing on the public sidewalk holding signs when they were approached by police. The police officer informed the men that they could not stand in their particular location because it had been marked by officials as being a no demonstration zone. When the men asked where they could go to engage in free speech activity, the officer directed them to a free speech zone located a block away from the entrance of Madison Square Garden. The area, which police had specifically erected for demonstrators, was the only location where expressive activity was allowed to take place during the event. Individuals of varying and opposite opinions were forced to stand together in one consolidated and caged area, which included a stage with a microphone. Markovich and LaFemme complied by walking away from the area alongside the officers and towards the zone that the NYPD had established. As they walked and were questioning the police about the purpose and reasoning behind the zones, they were placed under arrest for not relocating to the area fast enough. They took us to an abandoned warehouse where they funneled hundreds of people into cages that they had set up for this purpose, Markovich explained. They treated us like cattle. Only those who agreed with the message being delivered at a particular political or public event are now authorized to assemble in or around these areas. Anyone else is regulated to the cattle cages out of view of the public, the media, and the officials at whom their protest or grievance is directed. These zones are the very antithesis of free speech. It's not just judges ruling by decree that is stripping us of our rights to assemble and protest. In fact, the First Amendment itself has been, for recent congressional action, overridden by a new law that was passed earlier this year. The Federal Restricted Buildings and Grounds Improvement Act now allows national and local authorities to declare any venue they so choose as an event of national significance, at which point anyone who is found to be demonstrating in those areas can be charged under federal criminal statutes.
The new legislation allows prosecutors to charge anyone who enters a building without permission or with the intent to disrupt a government function with a federal offense if Secret Service is on the scene. It is not just the president who would be spared from protesters either. Covered under the bill is any person protected by the Secret Service, although such protection isn't extended to just everybody, making it a federal offense to even accidentally disrupt an event attended by a person with such status. Essentially crushes whatever currently remains of the right to assemble and peacefully protest. In the text of the Act, the law is allowed to be used against anyone who knowingly enters or remains in a restricted building or grounds without lawful authority to do so. And under the verbiage, that means a peaceful protest outside a candidate's concession speech would be a federal offense. With the definitions from domestic terrorism now taking on a broad scope of encompassing almost any activity deemed as such by the Department of Homeland Security and federal authorities, it is only a matter of time before peaceful demonstrators are not only detained for their criminal terrorist activities, but held indefinitely under U.S. anti-terrorism laws like the National Defense Authoritarian Authorization Act. That member of our Congress, and members of our Congress and appointed officials would first create, then uphold such laws designed to explicitly enact regulations in direct and overt violation of the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights is nothing short of a treasonous action. It is, by all accounts, a betrayal of the people of this country and of the established laws of the land. I totally, 100% agree with that. You know,
very scary.
You can check this out.
And that was by Mark Salvo.
Yeah, on Infowars.com.
Uh-huh.
Check that out. It was published today. And really, really quite frightening. And I've got a little something that really might scare you a little more.
We have a caller.
We do. Okay. Hang on 1 second. Let's see our callers.
Maybe they want to make a comment.
Sure. Good evening, 907.
Ooh. Hey,
hello.
It's Tim from Alaska.
Hey, how are you?
How are you?
How you doing?
Good. I was been out of town, but I got back last night, and I wanted to listen to your show today.
Oh, great. Welcome. I'm interested in following up on the salmon and the wildlife as a result of...
Yeah, you wanted to make a post on that, and we were
of what happened in Japan. How are the salmon running? What happened with that?
The numbers are terrible. There was maybe 12 to 17,000 escapement in Kenai. They shut it down.
Wow.
They had a few netters out there maybe 2-3 days of that for subsistence. And now it looks like Canada is not going to see their quota. They were expecting about 125,000 kings to run up the Yukon into Canada, and there was only like half of that ran up the river. So now they're shutting that down. And a lot of the natives are upset, obviously.
We were getting a Geiger counter last we talked. Did you?
I haven't had an opportunity to do it. I did work at this job site outside of Anchorage in Hope, Alaska, across the Turnagain Arm. We are seeing salmon, but they're low amounts.
Yeah.
And the silvers will be coming up in a week or so, and I'll know more.
Have you seen any of the debris or any unusual things going on there?
Of it washed up about 2 months ago, and then I haven't heard anything on the news. It was on for like maybe one or two episodes.
Yep.
And then they stopped.
They stopped reporting.
Talking about it.
Yeah.
Murkowski, Senator Murkowski, went out to look at it and inspect it, and then it was pretty much done. No one's talked about it.
Yeah.
And you don't hear anything about the seals anymore, but I have, you know, family that live up there, and they watch the shore all the time.
So there's
a lid on the news up here.
Turns out the seals have migrated to Florida and to the Cape for the summer. They're getting all kinds of reports on the large seal population and the sudden number of shark attacks on humans on the East Coast. So maybe the seals got smart and came east instead of to ward off the radiation poisoning.
Any information on the air quality in Alaska? Have you seen anything
I will say I haven't seen a lot of chemtrails this summer. It's been overcast a lot, but when it's nice out, I haven't seen the chemtrails. And that's pretty much around the state. They see a few here and there, but basically I think they shut down for whatever reason. I will say that. I haven't seen as many chemtrails. Not the crisscrossing of the sky. I have seen a few intermittently throughout the summer, but not like it was on a daily basis last summer.
It's been pretty heavy here. We've seen quite a bit of it.
New England.
Yeah, New England. So they haven't stopped. But so anything else going on up there that you noticed that you wanted to report on?
No, that's about it. I'm going to go out to the park, St. Elias, here probably at the end of the month, and do some inspections on what we talked about 2 months ago about what we said might be out there and on the border, and I'll let you know what I find.
Oh, we'd really appreciate that because we don't get much on that at all here in New England.
No, we haven't heard anything on any of it for about a month now.
But you haven't heard anything about the water quality or the air quality?
No, they're not giving that out anymore. They pretty much, other than what you guys probably have seen on internet. And to be honest, I'm not going to believe it unless I physically go out and test it and do it. And here at 10 of the month, that's exactly what I'm going to do.
Now, how close are you to the Pacific? Where are you located?
I'm right on the ocean. Yeah. Anchorage is right along the inlet, Cook Inlet.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. No, we're just about to ready to report on the mighty Mississippi running dry, and what's happening with the drought here in this country.
The Middle West is having such a terrible time with the weather. I my heart goes out to the farmers and the people
Can
there.
Can I ask you guys one question I missed? Who introduced that legislation you were talking about, the free speech zone?
Oh. Let's go back to that. Yeah, that's a good question.
I don't think it really said who introduced
that. That was proposed quite a while ago, and that was passed quite a while ago.
Yeah.
Hang on a second. Check it out. Hang on a second here. You can find that article on Infowars.com, by the way.
I wouldn't doubt Joseph Lieberman have something to do with that or McCain.
Oh, Lieberman, I'm sure it was all over.
That wouldn't be a surprise. But Ron Paul introduced legislation to audit the Federal Reserve.
That
didn't go anywhere, I guess.
Actually, it passed the House today or yesterday by a huge margin, but the Senate's not about to approve it. So.
And Obama's against it.
Yeah.
Well, I'll let you guys back to your show, and thank you very much for letting me call in.
Hang on a second. I got your answer here. If you just wait.
All right, you can hang up, and we'll give the answer on the air.
Let's see.
Okay.
Go to shifplan.com. And
it's
SHTF. Oh, I'm sorry, SHTF.com, latest bill from Congress. Hang on a second here. Just trying to bring this up.
I don't know why
that
enlarged that.
Well, it's not doing it.
Nope. Oh, there it is.
Okay. They didn't say it. They're not saying you're sponsored.
Federal Building Improvement Act of 2011 amends the federal...
The bill sponsor was Tom Rooney, Republican of Florida, claimed in a tweet responding to grievances on the Internet that H.R. 347 does not...
affect your right to protest in any way. Yeah, but you can do it from a cage.
Yeah, you can do it from a cage. But he sponsored this bill, all right? So Tom Rooney, Republican of Florida, responding to grievances, it deals with the fence jumpers, not protesters. Yeah, right. It turns out the two-page bill deals not just with fence jumpers, but also lays the groundwork for all protests, gatherings of political dissent in any facility or grounds in the United States of America that has been identified as a place of national significance or where Secret Service is charged with the protection of an individual. Any individual, whether it's a president, a congressional member, or anyone else of national interest. This came out after the Gabby, what's-her-face, I forgot her name.
The one that was shot.
Florida, Arizona. Gabby Gibbons?
Gifford?
Yeah, well, I forget. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about?
He hung up to listen to
answer.
So it's a Republican from Florida, Rooney is his name, that sponsored that.
Yeah.
So, and it's very restrictive.
So it's a two-page bill, but unbelievable. So anyway, I seem to be getting a lot of news from InfoWars tonight, but I'll tell you, the guy always comes up with some fascinating stuff, and I'm going to refer you to InfoWars.com tonight, and rather than play this, it's Al-Qaeda's Pride of the CFR, where the CFR Senior Counsel on Foreign Relations fellow Ed Hussein has hailed the presence of Al-Qaeda terrorists in Syria, praising their fighting prowess as aid of FSA rebels, while also lauding the increasing number of successful bombings carried out by Al-Qaeda fighters. I mean, weren't we at war with Al-Qaeda?
Well, one thought
aren't
so.
Aren't we at war with Al-Qaeda?
Well, wasn't
Didn't
that
we,
the war on terror?
Haven't we eliminated them from Afghanistan?
Apparently now we're on their side.
Yeah.
Are they on our side?
They're on our side in Syria now. Oh, yeah. So it's like, God, man. I mean, if you can't read between the lines, all right, Al-Qaeda was a CIA
invention.
Creation.
All
along. Okay?
Creation.
Now, Bin Laden's was drinking buddies with George H.W. Bush, all right, in the Carlyle Group. His brother is still a member of the Carlyle Group.
Mississippi to run dry. That's pretty scary.
It just freaks me out. Yeah, and we got a few minutes. I wanted to talk about the environment a little bit. And this article is quite frightening. Not that I care for this author as much, but it's
who's the author?
Sam Gardner.
No, Sarah Dry.
Yeah, but
what is the single greatest reason America is so wealthy? According to the analyst at Stafor, it's because of a river. They have to be joking, right? What about America's vast gold resources? What about its mountains of coal? America is the world's third largest oil producer. Surely that is why. Then there is America's temperate climate and fertile soils that traditionally make it the world's breadbasket. And don't forget America's human capital, Yankee ingenuity, and Protestant work ethic. Surely these factors are more and cumulatively important than a river. Not according to one of America's premier think tanks. Many countries have large natural resources and hospitable climates, but they don't even come close to Americans' wealth. What sets America apart is the Mississippi River Basin. It is what makes exploiting America's resources economically possible. But now, due to the worst drought since the 1950s, the Mississippi may be about to go dry. In Memphis and Vicksburg, the shrinking river is obvious. Slower river, exposed riverbanks, and more sandbars. The water is down more than 13 and 20 feet in each city, respectively. The Mississippi, on average, is about 13 feet below normal and a whopping 55 feet below where it was at this time last year. On some stretches, the water level is so perilously low. On July 16th, it was reported that a 100-mile stretch of the Platte River in Nebraska had dried up. In fact, water levels are now so low that barge operators are no longer able to operate at full capacity and have to shed both weight and number of towed barges. For each 1-inch loss of water, the standard barge must unload 17 tons of cargo. That is a loss of 204 tons per barge for every 1 foot loss. A typical tow on the upper Mississippi River may have 15 barges. At a 1 foot loss of water translates into a loss of 3,000 tons of capacity. Tows on the lower Mississippi River may have up to 45 barges, resulting in a loss capacity of over 9,000 tons. Tom Allegretti, president of the American Waterways Operators, reports it would take 130 semi-trucks or 570 rail cars to haul the freight unloaded by one large barge grouping under those conditions. Almost 600 rail cars just to make up for the loss of one string of barges. There are thousands and thousands of barge strings that fly the Mississippi each year. The shutdown of the Mississippi would be an absolute catastrophe.
Already the cost to ship bulk goods is rising. As the weight that can be put on barges shrinks, the cost per unit weight is rising, and that translates to higher costs to the consumer's end. Products that are already only marginally profitable may not be economic at these higher transport costs. The last time the Mississippi shut down due to low water was in 1988. Then just a small section of the river became uninhabitable, but it cost the shipping industry $1 billion. If the Mississippi shut down today, sources quoted by NBC estimate that the direct cost to the economy would be a massive $300 million per day, a cost that would skyrocket exponentially if the river did not open after more than a few days. We are still a few feet of water away from that, but the summer isn't over yet.
Pretty scary.
Yeah. Yeah. So, pretty freaky. And, let's see. We've got, what,
we just
3 minutes left.
A couple of minutes.
Well, we read this last week, I think, about GMO corn. Walmart. This is interesting. Biotech giants are bankrolling a GMO free-for-all. The so-called Big Six agrochemical companies, Monsanto, Syngenta, Dow, AgroSciences, BASF, Bayer, and Pioneer, DuPont, are sitting pretty. Together, they control nearly 70% of the global pesticide market and essentially the entire market for genetically modified seeds. Prices of the crops they focus on, corn, soy, cotton, etc., are soaring, pushed up by severe droughts in key growing regions. Higher crop prices typically translate to increased pesticide sales as farmers have more money to spend on agrochemicals and more incentive to maximize yield. The companies operate globally and have gained a strong hold in that emerging center of industrial agriculture, Brazil. But the biotech-friendly U.S. is their profit center. They've got a big chunk of U.S. agriculture pretty well sown up, and their GMO seeds dominate our corn, soy, and cotton crops, which account for more than 53% of U.S. farmland and have won approval for GMO alfalfa or hay, which accounts for almost another 19%.
The vast annual U.S. corn crop, which accounts for 40% of the globe's corn most years, is a particular bonanza, not just for GMO seeds, but also a stunning amount of insecticides, fungicides, and herbicides. We just have a minute.
Okay. And this article, by the way, is from Mother Jones. And I just wanted to see but two things could mess up the Big Six here in the U.S. Any delay in the regulatory process for a new generation of seeds for resistance, any major move to require labeling of foods contain GMOs and require already in play in many other countries, including European, Japan, China, and South Korea, in which the U.S. has expressed overwhelming support.
Unsurprisingly, the Big Six are investing millions of their vast profits into forestalling both of those menaces.
Yeah, they don't want GMOs labeled. And speedy driver.
Because people wouldn't buy them.
No, people haven't bought them in Europe. And, you know, the military, they put that shit on there. They don't want anything to do with it.
And it's now 9 o'clock.
Okay.
So we've come right to the end of our show.
And we want to thank everybody. If you want to go to this article, please go to MotherJones.com and check it out. Biotech giants are bankrolling a GMO free-for-all.
And Leo will be back with you tomorrow.
Yep.
And I will talk with you on Tuesday. I hope you guys have a nice evening and a great weekend that's coming up.
Right. And I want to thank everybody who joined me this on my Thursday night show. A tremendous audience. And, you know, for what we're doing lately. And I want to thank everyone for that. And please join me again tomorrow as I continue part four of the Confessions of an English Opium Eater.
So good night, folks. And have a great evening.
Good night, everybody.
What's left of it, right?
That was what's left. Good night, everyone.